Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Live to see it, friends, and welcome to the World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At the World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering on and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil, how are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, doing great. Starting another week here. There's some interesting stuff here in the show tonight. So,
well, you know, we're starting a week outright, you know. What topic better for a Monday than thinking about thinking? In fact, what topic is better for Monday than rethinking how we think, right?
I think. Yeah, what we did last week, put that aside. We're looking forward.
That's right. We're going to rethink all that. I don't know about you, but we've just started, and I'm already a little confused. But I think we'll push through it. It's interesting how these stories with an impact on the future seem to occur in clumps. Or I don't know, Stephen, you've just got a nose for finding trends as they occur. But this is one that I noticed was hitting us on several different in several different ways we were seeing stories about how, you know, just our basic models of thinking are being transformed. They're being challenged. And the reason they're being challenged is because new ways are emerging. And in a lot of instances, technology is the driver there, but not all, as we'll see in some of these stories. But I think this big one just kind of sets the stage, this first one here, this story from Wired. Put this up on Facebook, I think a week before last. And I, as always, am suspicious, skeptical about headlines. But the story, the name of the story was "The End of Theory: The Data Deluge Makes the Scientific Method Obsolete." And let's deal with that first before we do anything else, Stephen. Do you think the scientific method is obsolete?
Well, no. I mean, as long as actual humans are involved in the process of making science, people will continue to use the scientific method, Those who don't know what the scientific method is, you simply ask a question, you do some research, and then from that you construct a hypothesis, and then you begin to test it, and if it backs up what your hypothesis was, then eventually it can become a theory, right? And what you're doing there is you're trying to explain the world around you. Using science, and that's the scientific method. It appears, though, that there may be a new way to do not just science but everything, and it's being brought about by just huge mountains of data that we didn't have before, and from that we can do something different, right, Phil?
Well, that's right. I think it's a combination of the fact that we've got the data sets and we've got the software that can crunch it. We've got the software that can go in there and look for trends, that can identify patterns, that can do sufficiently sophisticated analysis on this data that it can pull things out of it without us having formulated a hypothesis to begin with. That's really the difference. Prior to that, if we were going to do quote-unquote scientific research, it had to follow exactly the model you just described, right? I mean, you know, you have an idea, you state a hypothesis, you go test the hypothesis. Well, in this Wired article that we link here, for example, not that anyone would have claimed this was pure research or that it was science anyway, but for example, something as sophisticated as Google Ads works without a hypothesis, right? There's no model what makes a successful page. There's no theory for, you know, what content is linked to something else. And they give some other really good examples too that speak to how far machine learning has come. That basically Google Translate speaks all these languages without ever having developed a model of the languages, right? Without there ever having been a stated, this is what the French language is. It just observes, it pulls all the data together, and voila, if you will, you've got the French language. You've got understanding without ever having come up with a model. Now, you can back into models with this kind of research, and that's why I think that it's wrong to say the scientific method is dead. I think what you've got now is the ability to discover these relationships. You've got a huge helper in defining models that you wouldn't have had before, and that's fantastic. There's a lot of knowledge out there to be found that we wouldn't have found without software looking for it. I think that's going to make a tremendous difference.
And it creates the opportunity to do science with artificial intelligence, doesn't it?
Right.
Google, for example, Google Translate. No one sat down with the AI at the Google, headquarters or whatever, and said, okay, water equals agua in Spanish.
Right.
No one sat there and taught the machine that way. What it did was it simply allowed the machine to suss out the relationships between words over various languages. And, given the same amount of data, it could do that with fictional languages like Klingon or, Lord of the Rings, Elvish, right? And so it's just looking at relationships. It doesn't require it to be taught the way a person would learn Spanish in a high school Spanish class or something. So,
right.
It's interesting. I saw this was not on our agenda this evening, Phil, but I saw an article last month about an AI for the first time doing science all by itself and using similar tools. It's let me just read you the headline here. AI does science, first model of regeneration discovered by non-human intelligence. It was you know how the Planera regrows parts of itself if you cut
right.
up,
right. Yeah, we've talked
type
about
of
that.
Worm. Yeah.
Yep.
And it came up with a model for this AI came up with a model of how this works, reverse engineered it basically, using these relationships, not using the traditional scientific method. So that's it's already being used in actual science in addition to your Google searches. It's this is the way a lot of things are going to be done going forward. Just mining the data, really.
Well, and there's a really strong reason why it should go that way. In the Wired article, they talk about how this gets applied to science, and they start off talking about how something we're all pretty familiar with, how Newtonian models of physics are accurate up to a point. But once we get into kind of a quantum physics understanding of the world, they start to break down and they don't give you as good a picture of the world as you need in order to do some of the things you need to do in this day and age. So that's a good example of when the model just doesn't suit you. And in fact, physics becomes a very good realm for research using using this kind of data-driven approach because it can see beyond the, you know, kind of the biases that we have built in around things like Newtonian models. But let me read a little section here because it talks about what comes after physics, and this is interesting. Now biology is heading in the same direction. The models we were taught in school about dominant and recessive genes steering a strictly Mendelian process have turned out to be an even greater simplification of reality than Newton's laws. The discovery of gene-protein interactions and other aspects of epigenetics has challenged the view of DNA as destiny and even introduced evidence that environment can influence inheritable traits, something once considered a genetic impossibility. In short, the more we learn about biology, the further we find ourselves from a model that can explain it. And when the model starts to break down that badly, right, when we're scratching our heads, a methodology that simply goes in and looks at the data and understands what's happening, that's powerful, right? It's like that's a way of, you know, continuing to learn even when our models have misled us or you know, once we've reached the point. Any model we come up with is only going to take it so far, right? Once you've reached the end of the line there is where it's going to take you, typically in the past, all work had to stop and you had to come up with a new model. And here, I think that's also what's happening, but kind of, as I said earlier, I think we're going to more back into the models, right? We're going to come up with new models that don't have the biases from previous ones. And that don't have our expectations of what's going to be found in the data. And it's very exciting and almost a little bit scary to think what potentially is sitting out there waiting to be learned because the computer's not afraid to find it, right? The computer's right. It's not going to overlook it. It will find it there in the data. And as we've noted in the past, there's an awful lot of data out there, so there's a huge potential for these kinds of things to be found.
Well, you know, the quantum world has often been described as, you know, if someone claims that they understand the quantum world, they don't understand the quantum world, right?
Right, exactly.
I've heard that. I think it might have been Stephen Hawking who said that. But at any rate, perhaps you don't need to understand some of these things. You just mine the data, you know. And you know, when you're beyond models and you're just finding the relationships, maybe that's how you do it going forward. And as you get deeper into these things, so that's interesting.
If I can read just more section because it's exactly on the money. Earlier in the article, they talk about how, you know, there's always been this, and you hear this all the time. You know, don't confuse correlation with causation. You can't just look at correlation in data. You've got to find the actual causation. And this article concludes with this kind of shocking statement. He says, petabytes allow us to say correlation is enough. We can stop looking for models. We can analyze the data without hypotheses about what it might show. We can throw the numbers into the biggest computing clusters the world has ever seen and let statistical algorithms find patterns where science cannot. Again, I think ultimately those patterns become our new models. And science ends up looking a lot like science always did, maybe with ultimately the AI taking the lead. But it's a huge change. It's a huge change in thinking, and it's one that I think most people aren't aware of. And I think they're not aware of the significance of it.
Well, I think it's very, very important. I think it's possible that this article overstates it just a little bit. But when something this huge is happening, you tend to overstate a little bit, perhaps, but I think it's a big deal.
What would this show be without the hype cycle? I mean, seriously, where would we be? But here's potentially an example of that sort of thing in action. Our second story, this headline: Stephen, to diagnose mental illness, read the brain. Now, what's going on here? This was in Scientific American. Actually, what does that mean? Don't we always read the brain when we? How else would you diagnose mental illness?
Well, I mean, generally, you know, if something's going haywire with Stephen and Geraldine says, "Hey, you need to get to the doctor. You're not acting right. You're out to lunch, obviously," and you know, which happens, you know, every so often, right? Right. So you go to the doctor. You say, "Well, doctor, here's what's wrong," and you give your symptoms to the doctor, right? And the doctor, in the case of mental illness, would diagnose something and would give you a pill to take perhaps to help with that problem, and then you know, hopefully it's
the problem solved, right? This is saying, this is going beyond that to say, you know, again, we're not trying to find the symptoms can be misleading. You know, I mean, if someone is mentally ill, they might not even be reporting it right to the doctor, right? Other symptoms or whatever.
And besides, a symptom
could, of a mental illness problem could be a symptom of two or three different, completely different mental illnesses that need to be treated completely differently, perhaps. So what they're doing now is actually mapping the brain and finding the relationships between the neurons, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I was really fascinated by this article, stuff I had not considered before. But, you know, going back to the previous story, when we talk about we've got these models and we work from these models, that's what doctors do. And in particular, that's what they do when treating mental illness. And the models are essentially complexes of symptoms when it comes to mental illness. But those models break down unexpectedly, and they're pretty unreliable. Symptoms turns out to be not a great way of diagnosing a mental illness, which I'm reading that and going, really? Who would have guessed? One of the things that I had never heard before I was reading in there is that how differently the symptoms of the same mental illness manifest in different cultures. So where in the U.S., something like depression, we typically think of it as meaning, you're very tired or, you're feeling down, you feel those kinds of things. I was reading in Asian cultures, depression might more read out, you might find the symptom to be, I can't sleep, right? That might be the primary symptom of depression. So there's this huge cultural component driving how we react to our symptoms anyway. And then on top of that, there's going to be this huge individual component driving how we respond to that underlying mental condition. But if you do a brain scan of an American person or a Chinese person who's suffering depression, they might use completely different words. They might describe completely different symptoms or somewhat different. But their brains look a lot alike, right? What's happening inside their brains, that looks the same. So even if we don't have good behavioral models or good symptom models, what we're getting emerging is a good structural model of what's happening in the brain when that occurs. And yeah, that's hard because we want to think that we're masters of the domain of the brain, that we understand everything that's going on there. And you know, there's this long established idea that a doctor can talk to somebody and can understand what's happening inside their brain and can respond accordingly. And what this is saying is, well, maybe they can, maybe they can't. But, you know, what if you take a picture of what's going on in the brain? You've got a good picture of what's going on in the brain.
Right. Well, it's a little bit like, think of this as like this, like a dawn of another age of treating mental illness. You know, once upon a time, if someone was having problems, they would sit down and, tell me about your childhood, Bill.
Right.
And you have long drawn out sessions, and and years later they might come up with something that they could do for you. Well, and people still get counseling, and that, I'm not discounting the value of that, but it's but typically nowadays, if somebody has a problem, you go to a psychiatrist, an actual medical doctor. You tell them the symptoms. And then the doctor prescribes, diagnoses you with a mental illness, a particular problem, and they give you medicine to deal with it. And this is the next stage after that. Think of this, Phil. I mean, what if one person is raised to, real stoic, you never say, you never admit any pain or problem or anything. What that person tells their doctor is very different from what a hypochondriac would tell the doctor, right?
Right.
And they could have the exact same problem as you were, like a person who's from one culture, a Chinese person versus an American. You know, they could be telling the doctor very different things and have the same problem. It's, again, it could be cultural too. So if this actually gets to the problem closer. This is like the next step after, you know, from psychotherapy to actual use of drugs and the MD to now this. This is the next stage, it seems to me. And very important step.
What it comes down to, when you think about it, is it's not just that the doctors don't have a sufficient model to diagnose. It's we don't have a sufficient model of our own internal workings, right? Ideally, right. I mean, think how weird this would be, but ideally, if we were robots, you would go to the doctor and you would say, I am experiencing a neurocortical malfunction, right? You know, this part of my brain is not working the way I expected. But obviously, we don't know that, right? We, you know, our system does not provide that kind of.
You just show up at the doctor in tears, saying something's wrong with me. You know.
Yeah, that's right.
That doesn't give enough information, obviously. So.
Exactly. You know, exactly. Now, the other interesting thing about this is it's not really related to the models or to our understanding, but I found it really interesting is in the interview that the doctor they're talking to about this also talks about the how you treat it. It's like, well, you're looking directly at the brain to have a better model of what's going on there. And now the way they're treating it is with transcranial stimulation. Rather than using a chemical to potentially provide some change in the brain, it's like they're sending currents directly into the brain to bring about those changes. So, I mean, when you look at it, it's this much clearer picture of what's going on, not necessarily with an understanding of why it manifests the way it does, but a much clearer picture, and then a much more direct treatment of the problem, all occurring, you know, to go back to our first story, maybe without kind of the grand theory, without the grand hypothesis for mental illness that we thought we had, maybe kind of challenging that in a lot of ways, but ultimately producing much better results because, we're right in the problem, right? It's those petabytes of data.
The doctor doesn't even have to have theory, does he, as to what's wrong? You know, somebody shows up in tears trying to tell them what's wrong. The doctor doesn't even, doesn't even have to have a clue. Say, well, obviously this person's got this kind of messed up. Let's see what's wrong. They do this, and they look under the hood. You know, it'd be a little bit like taking your car to the mechanic and he not being able to pop the hood to see what's going on with the engine. Now we can pop the hood, right? And and so much better. This is going to provide relief to a lot of people that are suffering, and that's great.
Yeah, and I think we'll see this occurring throughout the medical field. I think we're going to see it happening in a lot of different fields. But let's stay on the subject of let's stick with thinking here, and we can move it over into the business world a little bit. There's a couple of stories here that I wanted to touch on related to this, and the first one is from the San Jose Mercury News. Hacking the brain, Silicon Valley entrepreneurs turn to fasting and smart drugs. This is a really interesting story. First off, you want to note that it's a profile of a company called, I'm going to say, Nootrobox. So already they're in the space of, you know, working on performance. They're in the space of working on the kinds of issues that would be important to people who are interested in what kinds of things they can do to make themselves sharper, to enhance their business performance and those kinds of things. And of course, a lot of gimmicky things go on in Silicon Valley. I think that would be the big.
Right, can you picture this sort of thing happening in a company anywhere but in California specifically? Silicon Valley.
Not in America. Yeah.
it might happen in Japan or someplace outside of the United States. But if it's going to happen in America, it would have to be there. It's just sort of a cultural thing. And we laugh, though, at the same time. There may be something to this.
There may be something to it, but I'll put it to you, Stephen. Here's the thing. I'm going to guarantee you a 20% boost in your brain operations 4 days a week, all right? Are you ready? You will do whatever it takes for that 20% boost, right? Am I right?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
All I got to do is No food from Monday night until Wednesday morning. Okay, you just you fast from Monday night until Wednesday morning. Like, okay, I would maybe try that. I have actually fasted before and I never noticed that big boost, right? So I'm not buying it anyway. But to think of a whole company is doing this, right? And they're doing it because they think there's research to show it, and you know there could be a little bit of a placebo effect, a little bit of a social dynamic driving it through, or maybe they're really getting a benefit from it. But, you know, they're doing that, you know, going through that kind of extreme intervention, I would say, of not eating, fasting, to boost their brain power, right, to make themselves perform a little bit better. And the story goes on to talk about – oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it reminds me of you know, friends I've had that for spiritual reasons, you know, would fast. And I would ask them why what benefit do you get from denying yourself food? I mean, and the response was always some flavor of this answer, Phil. It was like, well, it is a very it's a reminder to myself that I'm more than a physical body.
Mm.
Okay, it's by denying this physical thing, you know, for a period of time. It enhances the spiritual side of myself. I'm more than just this machine walking around. And I think that it's, and maybe something like that is going on with, you know, in the secular world when people choose to fast. Maybe it turns the brain on because you're not just dealing with the mundane aspect of, shoving food in your face. I don't know. So
it's entirely possible, you know, that there is a biochemical interaction that's going on there, and that if you look for it, you can find it and leverage it. I'll just say that when I fast, I am never more aware of the fact that I'm a physical body, right? I mean, that's me.
Yeah.
You know?
I have found, I'm not a big faster. I've not done a whole lot of that, but when I look in the mirror and realize, hey, I need to drop some pounds off. The successes that I've had in that has always been with low carb dieting, and I can tell you, especially during the first two or three weeks of a low carb diet, vivid dreams of pastries. I mean, it's hilarious. Like it's like, you know, it's the most vivid thing in the world. I had donuts and, you know, it's hilarious. I wake up, literally chewing, you know.
Well, do you see what happens, Stephen? For some of us, yes, there is this huge mental boost, but unfortunately all the mental power is going to thinking about food, right? So if you're trying to improve your business, it doesn't necessarily help. Maybe for some people it does.
Well, maybe maybe by doing it the way these guys are doing, one day a week, I mean, you know, for your thought processes go, you know, 100% to food, perhaps your thought processes are going a little bit towards what it is that needs to be accomplished at work. I don't know. But because they're only doing this thing.
But fasting aside, because it goes on to talk about some companies are not into that. You know, they've tried it and they've had similar responses to ours. But what you do read about here is the increase in use of nootropics, and also the use of we've talked about this a little bit before, microdoses of hallucinogens. Basically, Silicon Valley has become just one big lab with people experimenting on different. You know, actually, this is a valid statement for California over the last few decades too, right? Trying different things out on their brains, and the thing is, this is more focused and this is more aimed at performance than what we've seen in the past. Maybe some things will emerge here. Certainly, we've heard interesting things about modafinil and some of these others, some of these other nootropics. Our friend Jab has talked to us about that one in the past. Whether any of this emerges as kind of a standard thing, or whether I kind of feel like this whole field is still sort of struggling. That we're just in the, you know, kind of the pre-dark ages of understanding how we boost our brain performance and how we make it go.
But I mean, the typical person. I mean, it's just a cup of coffee, right?
Yeah.
That you don't go beyond that. I mean, every morning I have a cup of coffee, and that's kind of the boost. But they're saying, hey, we can be a little more sophisticated than that, and perhaps they're right. I'll But I'll let Silicon Valley do the experimenting for me, and we'll all learn from what they learn. So
I do like that. There's one photo that accompanies this story in the San Jose Mercury News, and I don't know which company it is, but it's a they're showing people eating. Maybe they're not a company. Actually, I guess it's showing them at a restaurant. But this girl with pink hair is just sitting down to eat. She's got a big plate of bacon in front of her. There's sausage in the foreground, and she's reaching for the butter. Okay. Now, if that's the all I can say is if that's the brain diet, okay.
This must be the big meal they have when they break the fast, you know, after 36
probably
hours.
Probably so.
They meet for breakfast at El Moro Restaurant in San Francisco. Some are coming off the 36-hour fast. Some are on the 24-hour fast, and some are not fasting. Well, none are fasting at this particular table at this moment. They're all eating pretty good, looks to me like. So.
Exactly, yeah. I like that picture anyhow. All right, so speaking of changing thinking in business, I linked this story from the Data Warehousing Institute, How and Why to Build an Analytics-Driven Culture. Now, this is pretty standard stuff. This is by a friend of mine, actually, Sean Rogers. And I'm sorry, Sean, when I say it's pretty standard stuff, but I just mean for this show. There's some good solid business advice about leading from the top down, developing clear business objectives, openly sharing data and information. But the step four, I think, is important. This idea of empowering the citizen data scientist, something I've seen in the last couple of years as big data has come on big, as this kind of shift towards a more data-centric world and data-centric business modeling has taken over. You've got this idea of everybody does analytics now. It's almost every job touches that these days in a lot of these companies, and you know there's the creme de la creme of the data world is the data scientist. Somebody who sits up there at the very top, you know, the pinnacle, really understands the statistics. And, you know, a few years ago they were talking about how you could come right out of school. In fact, you didn't even finish school and you were making $500,000 a year as a data scientist. Well, now we see the emergence of the citizen data scientist. Basically, the tools are sufficiently powerful that the average Joe can go in and do some really amazing stuff with data. It's like the systems are smart enough that that everyone is doing data science. So, you know, business itself is changing in terms of how we're interacting with data and what how we're looking at business. So we're essentially looking at business anymore. We're looking at the world anymore. Business kind of leading the way here as a big pile of data. And so being facile with it, you know, being able to manipulate it, being able to understand it, that's becoming increasingly critical for succeeding in business and ultimately, I think, for succeeding in the world. It's almost kind of a natural, when you think about our first story about the, it's kind of the change in scientific thinking, it's almost kind of a natural result of that. As that kind of data-driven process informs everything that we do, it's like we have to, we have to pick it up too. We have to become the data processors ourselves, don't we?
Right. Well, and particularly for smaller companies, I mean, if you're running a small company, Phil, you might not have access to these big data guys, right? So you might have to do it yourself. And so,
That's exactly right. I mean, it's another example of something we talk about all the time, which is a capability that once belonged to an elite few or a powerful few.
Right.
Finding its way into the hands of regular people. And yeah, these days, the average line manager has at his or her disposal analytical power that at one time was completely unavailable to, even the head of R&D, right, at some big Fortune 500 company. So it's that kind of change in the thinking that goes around it. So finally, if this all becomes too much for you, you can train your monkey mind with meditation. And what I like about this one, Stephen, is this is as low tech as it could possibly be. But if you try this, this actually works. There's so much talk about meditation. And, you know, getting control of our brains and changing our brains, getting them into different states. And this Tibetan monk explains how you can meditate very differently than I've ever heard it described before. It talks about taking this focus away from concentrate and focus, and basically to just pay attention to your breathing. And great graphic in the video of having this little monkey chattering away inside your head, and how you you train the monkey to do what you want it to do, and you get control of your brain. I'd like to see a lot more of this kind of thing, you know, kind of these shortcuts to making ourselves perform better. I like this because all you have to do is breathe and think about it rather than, you know what I mean?
He also says in this video that you don't need like an hour and a half to sit there and with your legs crossed on the floor meditating. You can do this walking, you know, for 5 seconds walking down the street, you know.
Exactly, yeah. A few seconds will get you going. I think it's a great technique. Everybody check that out and give it a try, because you too can change your thinking. Well, Stephen, this has been fun talking about rethinking our thinking, and I think, you know what, this is going to impact our thinking throughout the rest of the week. What do you think?
I'm on it, man.
All right, well, we'll be back.
I think I'll do without food until we talk next. How about that?
That's a great idea. I'm gonna do the same. We'll see if we'll see what results. I think we're gonna see some exciting new stuff. Well, thank you all for being with us, Stephen. It's always fun. We'll be back again Wednesday with an all new show. And until next time, live to see it.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.